Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Exodus 3, 1 through 12, The All-Consuming Conversation, presented by Michael Pollitt. Disc number POK2005-05.
Good morning to all of you. Disappointingly, I am not Rabbi Marx. Unfortunately, his time with us ended yesterday, and he's left again. But we are going to continue to look at our theme text for the summer, from which we get the phrase, take off your shoes. And so we're going to continue to look at Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. So that'll be our key text. And what I want to look at it today, the title I've given for this session, is that what begins here in Exodus chapter 3 is an all-consuming conversation. And that basically, if you look at Moses' ministry, Moses' call, what's happening from Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, on and on, much of what Moses does is spent in conversation with God. Moses and God have a lot of things to talk about. And that conversation, if you will, consumes Moses' life. And so I want to begin to look at the start of that conversation, which happens here in chapter 3, in terms of how that conversation begins with the call of Moses, and look at that as well in terms of how we can understand our callings and our ministries in the world, our life of faith as an all-consuming conversation with God, and some of the implications for that and what that might mean. And so to start here, given that chapter 3 is what would be called, what one would designate as Moses' call, there are many instances of calls where God calls a prophet or God calls a judge in both the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. And as biblical scholars have looked at this, they have noted that there is a form or a structure in the call narrative. And they say that one can outline this structure of a call into six different components. There's that initial encounter with the divine, or there's a divine appearance. There's an introductory word. Then there is the divine commission, or what one would say is something like the call proper. And then there is the objection of the one being sent or called. There's reassurance, and there is a giving of the sign. And if you look at all the different call narratives within the scriptures, they pretty well fit within this kind of structure. And so let's look at Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. Take a look. In fact, let's have someone read it out loud for us, please, if someone will. Just anyone who feels the call.
Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain.
Okay, thank you. Now, as we read through that, if we would have to try to put those things together, what in this narrative would we first say is the encounter with the divine and the divine appearance? Where is that?
The burning bush.
The burning bush, right? All those verses that talk about the burning bush. In terms of conversationally speaking, right, this is kind of your icebreaker. So if any of you are trying, you know, the next party you go to and say, boy, what's the icebreaker I can use to start a conversation? The burning bush icebreaker always gets something, right? It's a great way to start a conversation. It's a little difficult for us, but it really works. So there's, right, look at it that way. This is the icebreaker, right? And pretty good one at that. What's the introductory word?
I am the God of your father.
All of that part is the introductory word. What's the divine commission or the call proper? Right. Send you to Pharaoh. The objection?
Who am I?
The reassurance?
I will be with you.
You guys are unbelievable. For 9 o'clock, you folks are sharp. And the giving of a sign?
Staff sign. After you come out of Israel, out of Egypt, you will come back to this mountain.
Right. Worship at this mountain. Okay, so you can see how that breaks down and works out very nicely. Now I want to look at one more call narrative so you can see how this works. And for this call narrative, I'd like you to look at Luke chapter 1, verses 26 to 45. Luke chapter 1, verses 26 to 45. And again, maybe so that you can keep think about this six-part structure again, and if a few folks would be willing to read that through. So if someone would read five or six verses and then let someone pick it up. So that again, we hear this word and then think about these six aspects of a call structure as we go through it. Someone just start, please.
In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent by God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph from the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and said, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was much perplexed by his words and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus.
He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his ancestor David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I am a virgin?" The angel said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be holy. He will be called the Son of God."
"And now your relative Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son. And this is the sixth month for her who was said to be barren. For nothing will be impossible with God." Then Mary said, "Here am I, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." Then the angel departed from her.
Okay. If we have to outline that, how would we have here at first the encounter with the divine or the divine appearance? What do we have?
The angel.
Gabriel. Okay. The introductory word.
Greetings,
favored one. The divine commission.
You'll conceive.
The objection.
How can this be?
The reassurance,
the Holy Spirit.
The giving of a sign,
Elizabeth
is pregnant. Now, the interesting thing I think about that is what Luke, this sly guy, is doing. That, for example, if you read the Gospel of Matthew, there Jesus is portrayed as kind of the new Moses, right? Jesus has the Sermon on the Mount and all of that, and kind of like Moses, he says this. But in Luke's Gospel, who's the new Moses? Mary. Mary is Moses. Think about that one for a minute. I mean, Mary's been called a lot of things, but usually not called Moses. But that Luke sees Mary's function, if you will, as Moses. She is the one who is the bearer of the word of deliverance, just like Moses is the bearer of the word of deliverance. Just like all of us upon whom the Holy Spirit comes are bearers of the word of deliverance. So that one of the things in terms of the conversation is to say, how do you see this call structure working out in your life? Where was that encounter with the divine at first? And it might not have been the burning bush or Gabriel. Some of us might say something like, well, you know, that first encounter happened when I really didn't even know about it, when I was baptized at 3 weeks or whatever. For some of you, that encounter might have been somewhere else, a very specific place and time that you know about in that. And there was an introductory word that came there. And again, maybe it was almost pretty innocuous, like, hi. All right, I mean, that's all greetings is. It's just, you know, hi, how's it going? Then the divine commission, that sense of sending, your vocation, your ministries, your calling, whatever that might be. And this is, I think, the one we can all identify with the most. The objection, oh, no, 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 not me, not, you know, who am I, or how can this be, or I'm sorry, God, but you've got the wrong person, right? Then comes the reassurance. And here again, I would say, reassurance is what should be happening every week, if you will, in worship. The preaching of the gospel is always, again, hearing that reassuring word. And it always is in some kind of form of, I will be with you, or the Holy Spirit is with you, that way in which God is with us. And so in our callings and in this conversation that is beginning of our in our lives with God, we hear that reassuring word. And then there is that giving of a sign, whatever that might be. Those indicators, again, that show us, yes, God is at work. And again, they might be very small indicators. It doesn't have to be grandiose, but it's there. So that the first thing I ask you to think about is how this structure of a call, how this beginning of a conversation with God is happening and is at work in your lives. Because our claim as Christians, as followers of God in that sense, is that we too are like Moses, called and sent to be ones to pronounce words of deliverance and salvation to one another and to others around us. And so that's the first thing to think about in this conversation. You see how that works? Any kinds of questions or more comments? No. Yes, please.
I could see that in Moses' case, he was actually almost on a quest because he saw the burning bush, he was drawn towards it. Whereas in Mary's case, she was, it's almost like she's being solicited. Someone comes to her out of nowhere and says, hey, you know, you're going to do this. So she was the more passive as opposed to Moses, who seemed to be the more active person.
Yeah, although it's, certainly Moses has that curiosity because he sees that bush burning and then goes toward it. But initially, you could say, Moses is just out there in the wilderness tending the sheep, minding his own business, and then all of a sudden there's this bush over here that starts burning. What's going on? Right? So I think, you know, again, initially, Moses isn't doing anything out of the ordinary. But you're right about that kind of second move. Curiosity lures him there. Or in our contemporary phrasing, you could say, I guess Moses is a seeker. Well, right? Right? He sees something there and he says, I gotta check this out. I wonder what's going on there.
But also in 38, we read that far. It says, then Mary said, here I am, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word.
Mm-hmm.
She could have said, forget it. I'm out of here.
Yes.
I mean, there's a course, you know, bullet points. They're kind of, there's a moment of some amount of choice.
Yeah.
And they both accept.
Right.
Actively.
She says, here I am. And Moses says initially too, here am I.
Right.
Anything else that anyone wants to say about this sense of call and how we begin to initiate this conversation?
Well, I thought it interesting that God does not speak to Moses until Moses responds to the burning bush. He actually needs to, God is observing us in our response to the fishing lure that's just kind of dangling out there.
Yeah, that's a great metaphor for that, isn't it? That God is really lurid many times, right? There's all sorts of burning bushes that are out there. I mean, that what is God doing again in your lives? It kind of pique or tweak your curiosity to kind of get you to lean a little bit toward what's going on here. Yeah. Anything else?
I think it's interesting the Paul narratives in the Old and the New Testament. So it seems to be the Christians and Hebrew tradition have in common.
Right, yeah. I mean, just to give a couple other references, if you're interested about more call narratives, you can find this for Gideon in Judges chapter 6.
Samuel?
Samuel doesn't have quite the same call narrative. I mean, it is God coming to Samuel, but Samuel needs Eli to kind of help him understand what's going on there. There's that call narrative for Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6 and in 2 Isaiah chapter 40, verses 1 to 11. You see this with Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 1. Ezekiel in the first three chapters, it's there. And then again, as I've said, the call of Mary. So there's all these call structures. Those are kind of the seven key call structures that you can talk about in all of this.
And Paul's is different?
Huh?
Paul's is different too because of another person involved?
Yes, Paul's is different too, and Paul understands, I mean, if you will, Paul himself understands the Damascus experience as a resurrection appearance of Jesus, even more so than the call. Although, again, the function of those resurrection appearances does have a mission aspect to it, ascending aspect. Yeah. Okay, then once we've got this conversation going, from chapter 3, verse 1, you could go to chapter 7, verse 7. That whole section, which we're not going to look at all of that, but just to outline this, from 3, verse 1 to 7, verse 7, the conversation goes on, and the conversation goes on in terms of objections and responses. So that, in other words, Moses does not simply object once, like we have here in chapter 3, and get reassurance and then says, oh, okay, let's go for it, God. Moses keeps having objections, and each time God responds, so that in all there are 8 objections and 8 responses. And so again, we could, if we have lots of time or in another session, go through all those objections and responses. Again, what does that tell us? How do we understand, or how might we understand what this has to say for our own conversations with God? Because I'll be bold enough to say the chances are in your conversations with God, you may have objected more than once. Right? Just like Moses. And so what does that help us to see? Well, the interesting thing here is that when God calls, when we are in the presence of the holy, if you will, that is not a purely passive experience. Indeed, God comes to us. God is the initiator of the action. That's where it begins. But after that, in this conversation, there's disagreement and argument and challenge. I mean, I think one of the wonderful things of the Hebrew scriptures and within the Hebrew tradition, what in the Jewish tradition, what they remind us about is that living with God and talking with God is really kind of at times down and dirty arguing. And that we often have this kind of false piety that, you know, whenever we talk to God and when God talks to us, we have to be nice. And I think one of the things is if you read through all of this and the objections and everything that's going on is that God is not always nice. And certainly Moses is not always nice. But to just to point out one spot within the tradition here where God is not always nice as we talk about this. This is chapter 4, verse 24. I'll just read that from the New Revised Standard. On the way at a place where they spent the night, the Lord met him and tried to kill him. That's a pretty serious conversation, isn't it? And not particularly being nice. But again, just illustrative of the give and take, the back and forth, the disagreement and challenges that come here. In other words, God's calling of us invites rather than silences or repels our human response. God wants us, God invites us to be in dialogue, to be in conversation. Another thing, particularly about Moses, which I think is great irony and probably some good Hebrew humor as well, that one of the objections that Moses has to this call is to say, well you know, God, you can't call me because, you know, I don't talk real good. Right? That somehow Moses has this speech impediment. Some folks think it's something like stuttering or whatever. Others believe that, you know, he's just not a very good speaker and that he certainly couldn't do that and could not be God's messenger, God's mouthpiece, if you will, to Pharaoh and all the powers of Egypt. And the irony in this, I think, is that although Moses says, well, I'm not really a good speaker, I have this impediment, you know, he holds his own talking to God. For a guy with a speech impediment or who don't talk real good, he's doing pretty fine. He's doing mighty fine in terms of that discussion with God. And so there's again that sense that in God's coming to Moses, already there inviting Moses into the conversation, God also empowers us and enables us to be a serious and valid conversation partner. In that respect, again, God treats this dialogue with integrity. God listens to what Moses has to say. Again, as Moses objects and God responds, you again see, if you will, negotiation going on. God adapts. That initially, as we've read this call, God says, I'm sending you, Moses, to go to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And Moses said, well, I can't talk. I mean, and God says, well, all right, then I will be your mouth. Don't worry about that. And Moses said, well, thanks, God. I appreciate that. But even your mouth in my mouth isn't good enough. And God said, well, all right then. Aaron, your brother, will be your mouth. So, well, okay, I guess I can't say much against that now. Okay. But note again that back and forth, how both God and Moses are adapting and adopting their positions, right? It's not a done deal from the very beginning, as that never happens in a genuine conversation, right? It's back and forth, to and fro, as we kind of live that conversation. So here for Moses and God, it is a dynamic understanding, and an understanding in which both of the people in that conversation, if you will, change and adapt in how they should go. Okay, a few more things with regard to the text and some of the specifics that we have here in the text that I think help enrich our understanding. The first thing is that we read in verse 1 that Moses is tending his father-in-law Jethro's flocks on Horeb. And again, Horeb is a proper name and everything, but in Hebrew, Horeb literally means wasteland. And so, if you will, Moses is on Mount Wasteland in the hinder parts of the wilderness. In other words, it's about as desolate as you can get, as far removed from community, from civilization, society, whatever you want to say, right? There you are on Mount Wasteland in the wilderness. One could also say that would be the last place you would expect God to show up. So there's Moses. And of course, Moses is pretty much a wasteland himself. Remember, at this point, Moses is a fugitive. He has nothing to his name. He's not even tending his own sheep. He's tending his father-in-law's sheep. At best, he's a kind of, if you will, a hired hand, and since he's married into the family, he probably doesn't even get minimum wage, right? Because that's how it works in families sometimes. We won't go there, right? But that sense, he certainly is not one who could yet be called a priest, a prophet, a leader. He's a fugitive, a nobody. So there you have nobody on Mount Wasteland. Certainly, in that sense, to say, if God is luring Moses, Moses isn't that great a lure for God, right? Nobody on Mount Wasteland. Sounds like me, right? Sounds like us in that sense. And yet, God comes, right? God appears to this shepherd in the wilderness. And for us as Christians, we too recognize that this isn't the last time that God appears to shepherds in the wilderness with good news. It kind of seems like God is in a habit, has got a maybe even a bad habit of appearing to shepherds in wilderness, announcing good news of deliverance and salvation, peace, goodwill. And so again, for all of us, nobody's on Mount Wasteland. Whatever it is that we're shepherding, God will come and declare to us this good news. Now, how does God come? We know that God comes here in a burning bush, right? And that God is not the form of the flame of the burning bush itself, but God is in the flame of the bush, in that sense of fire. And within the Hebrew scriptures, that fire kind of symbolizes three things. Fire symbolizes holiness, and we keep that image that, you know, you can purify and purge things with fire. So it is pure, it is holy in that sense. Fire symbolizes passion or zeal. And again, that can either be positive or negative, right? God at times is on fire for God's people in terms of love for them. And at other times, God's anger waxes hot because of what they've done. And he really wants to make them toast. And Moses says, well, wait a second, God. I don't think that would be a good idea. Right? And so that's part of that conversation. But fire is that sense of passion. And fire also has a sense of mystery. So that as God is in this fire, there is this God of holiness and of passion and of mystery. And we see this illustration of fire within a bush, if you will, in the same way, if someone would read Exodus chapter 19, verse 18, and someone else Deuteronomy 4, verse 12. And if you, when you find it, just read it. Exodus 19, 18, and Deuteronomy 4, 12.
Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord had descended upon it in fire. The smoke went up like the smoke of a kiln, while the whole mountain shook violently.
Okay, and the Deuteronomy passage, please.
Then the Lord spoke to you out of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but saw no form. There was only a voice.
Okay. So in both Exodus and Deuteronomy, we have that same notion of fire, but now where's the fire? Or what's the fire? What's on fire?
The mountain.
The mountain. So there's an analogy here. Just like the bush is on fire for the call of Moses, so the mountain, Sinai, is on fire when all of Israel is once again reassembled and they get their call. Not a coincidence, I will say, because remember, the giving of the sign was they were going to again worship at this mountain. And remember, Horeb and Sinai are synonyms. They depict the same mountain, the same place. So in other words, if you will, the sign is just like Moses had this burning bush experience, when Israel is delivered, they too will have the burning bush experience. If you will, Sinai is another burning bush. And another thing in Hebrew, which will help illustrate that, is the word, if you will, the word for bush in Hebrew is Sena. And if all you're doing is listening, Sena Sinai, Sena Sinai, almost sounds the same. So that, if you will, this is God appearing to Moses, God appearing to Israel in the burning Sinai, in the burning bush. In other words, the point that is being made here is that the experience that happened for Moses is again an experience which happens for all the Israelites, for all of God's people. And again, for us, we could say it will happen for us as God's people. Our burning bush, our burning Sinai, where God appears to us and again calls us into God's ways.
Did they change
Does the name change from Horeb to Mount Sinai through this process of it becoming more prominent in this story?
I don't know. I mean, I think just as sometimes for us, a place has two different names and all of that. Maybe the Midianites called it Horeb and the Perizzites called it Sinai, and it's used interchangeably, or it could be from different traditions. And I think here again, the writers of the scriptures use the word Horeb or Sinai in terms of what best suits their purpose. So when you're trying to get Moses in the wilderness on Mount Wasteland, you're going to use Horeb. When you want to make that link to God's appearing again, that burning bush experience, then you want Sinai, because you've got Sena Sinai, and that's going to trigger, this is God doing something here. Pay attention. So I think that's what the writers are trying to get at. Okay, from here, I'd like to move on to the part within this that talks about the sending of Moses and what that involves. And particularly, I want to focus on verses 7 through 10, chapter 3, verses 7 through 10. And again, what I think are some of the interesting things going on here for conversation and for thinking about what our calling is and how God is at work in our lives calling us. And again, to just remind us of that, would somebody please read those verses again? Chapter 3, verses 7 to 10. Anyone.
The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites.
Yeah, all those ites.
Through 10?
Yes, please.
And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt.
Okay, thank you. The first thing I want to note here is again, that kind of tricky way that God works. In verse 9, God says, I have seen how the Egyptians oppress them. And you go, well, God has seen that. What's God going to do about that? God says, therefore, I will send you. Right? Note that I have seen you are sent. Note that transfer that happens there from that I to you. And yet all of this, even the sending of the you, of the us, if you will, is seen as part of God's action. It's still God's claim that this is what I am doing. What am I doing? I am sending you. And again, the emphasis, if you want to take the time to count, you would find that first person singular pronoun, I, occurs 6 times in these verses. You get the sense there that God is pretty involved. Right? I, and then after all those I's, you. But that you is, again, so closely connected to the I. Right? So that you say, what is God doing about this? God is sending you. So when you think about that, that never lets us off the hook. Right? What is God doing about world hunger? What is God doing about peace and justice? What is God doing about whatever you think God should be doing something about? Answer, sending you. So you never get off the hook, do you? That commitment by God to work through you, to work through Moses. Again, that kind of interesting little switch that is there. That if you look in verse 8, right, God says, I have come down to deliver them. Okay, how do you do that? Verse 12, that phrase, when you have brought the people out of Egypt. I deliver, you bring them out. The interesting thing there is that's supposed to be understood as synonyms. It's the same phrase. How does God deliver? You bring them out. How do you bring them out? That's God's delivering. In that sense, it's a real team, if you want to put it that way. The way in which God works, right? God does not work alone. And certainly Moses does not work alone. But God acts and works in and through the work of Moses. One more example that illustrates that I think is somewhat interesting. Exodus chapter 14, verse 31. And I'll read that one. This Exodus 14, 31 is the very end of the Red Sea. So Israel has left its place in Egypt. They've just gone through the Red Sea. And in verse 31, then, it reads, Israel saw the great work that the Lord did against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Right. Again, that sense about how both are, you know, I delivered, you bring them up. The people believed in the Lord and in Moses. In other words, there's no distinction there in terms of God and Moses are doing the same thing. They're involved in this together. And again, a way of understanding our calling, I think, is in terms of being involved in these things together. Why do we need God for liberation, for doing any of these things at all? Couldn't Moses have done it on his own? And here I think, indeed, Moses tried. I mean, in some senses, we think Moses the great liberator. Actually, this is kind of the second time Moses has tried to do this. If you will, he tried to do this once on his own and failed. If you go back to chapter 2, verse 11 and following. Exodus chapter 2, 11 and following. And here, just to recount what's going on, because I think this is familiar to you. Verse 11 there, one day after Moses has grown up, he went out to his people and saw their forced labor. Just like that phrase we've read here in chapter 3, Moses, or God, sees the oppression of his people. Moses sees the oppression of his people. Same word that is used in both places. Saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinfolk. Looks this way, that, and of course, God, Moses kills the Egyptian. So you say, wow, boy, act of liberation, deliverance, and so forth. But it didn't quite work that way because we see in verse 13 that Moses' kinfolk, right, there's two Hebrews fighting, and Moses goes to them, and again, why do you strike your fellow Hebrew? In other words, he also wants to settle disputes, which he's going to do later all the time as well. So he's going to try to do that. And they, of course, answer, who made you a ruler and judge over us? You want to kill us like you did the Egyptians? So, you know, apparently they don't see Moses as the great deliverer, right? Kind of fails there. So Moses kind of recognizes what's going on. And, of course, when Pharaoh finds out about this, Moses has to flee. There he goes now into Midian. But even there in Midian, as the story goes on, note what happens. He's out there. He's in that area of Midian. He stops at a watering hole, and Jethro's daughters are coming out there to draw water to fill the flock water their flock. And other shepherds come along and bully them and drive them away and all that terrible stuff. And of course, Moses, again, Mr. Justice, stands up for these women and, you know, takes away those, or shoos away those other shepherds and helps these women draw water for them and so on and so forth. And he ends up marrying one of Jethro's daughters, so on and so forth. So he is always involved in these notions of justice and deliverance. But note how that all ends up. The very last sentence in verse 22, when he has a son named Gershom. I have been an alien residing in a foreign land. That all of his work, whether it's with the Hebrews or others, when he tries to do his own deliverance project and so on and so forth, he ends up an alien or alienated. And that's where we find him, as I said at the beginning then of chapter 3, right? Mr. Nobody on Mount Wasteland. Our wanting to do things, to deliver, to work for justice, and so on and so forth, at times come to naught, leave us feeling alienated, what? Without God at work. It's the kind of thing that it is only when Moses has a word to speak which comes from God, that justice and deliverance and salvation happen. Again, just to link that up with Mary. When Mary has that word from God, that word incarnate, justice, deliverance, salvation happens. And so too for us, right? Without the Word, without God's working within us, our own works, our own attempts solely by ourselves for justice, deliverance, whatever, may leave us feeling dry, alienated, wasted. And so again, it is that kind of dynamic at work that is important. The last thing, and then I hope we have a little time for discussion, is Moses' movement. He was very positive. He first saw the burning bush and comes closer and says, "Here am I." And later, once God tells Moses what to do, he says, "Who am I?" So that the kind of movement here is that Moses moves in terms of a notion of kind of from affirmation, I'm ready to go, to reluctance. In other words, he's kind of moving downhill. And again, the kind of reassurance that God gives to him, verse 12, is that word, I will be with you. And again, for all of our callings, when we at first seem to have a sense of affirmation, of readiness, and then we take 20 seconds to think about it and go, whoa, and reluctance sets in quite quickly about who am I? The word of promise there is, I will be with you. Moses is assured of God's constant presence. That no matter where Moses will go, no matter what Moses will do, he will not be left to his own resources. Like back in chapter 2, when he tried to handle it on his own. I will be with you. The other interesting thing here, I think, is to say, Moses doesn't even know who he is.
Right.
Who am I? And God saying, I will be with you, is God's way of saying both, I know who I am, because that I will be is going to, a little later in verse 14, turn into God's very name, I am what I am, or I will be who I will be. So God says, don't worry about it so much, Moses, because first of all, one, I know who I am, and secondly, I know who you are. And so both the scary and the reassuring thing here is God knows us better than we know ourselves. And most of us, I think, are pretty confident that we have a pretty good sense of who we are, that we know ourselves quite well. And yet here we see that beginning conversation, that beginning call is God telling us, well, you know, you maybe really don't even know yourself that well. I know you better than you know yourself. And therefore, you can do this because I will be with you. And from there on, the conversation continues. Any thoughts, comments that you might have on these, the sense of calling, how you maybe see yourselves in this understanding of calling, the sense there of moving from kind of readiness to reluctance, from affirmation to reluctance. Are you like Moses as well?
Yes.
To understand this perspective, I'm a teacher and I work with adolescents, but I see this metaphor for the call in a lot of the hero worship movies that we have, Spider-Man, you know, various movies about Batman, Superman, those kind of things. They all seem to have that, they're driven to do this, and then there's this reluctance, they try and hide from their what they see as their responsibility. And I wonder if you think that has become part of a kind of an archetype in our literature, or if that's present there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is an archetype of that, but I think where the distinction comes in is that all those, you know, all those heroes, Spider-Man, and now what's the movie? Batman is going to be the big blockbuster for the summer, right? Because the brooding superhero again. But I mean, the thing is, I think they're all like Moses of chapter 2. They see that again, there's that call, that sense they got to do something, just like Moses in chapter 2 thought he had to do something. And in that, but there again, what we see that ends up for him in terms of leaving him alien and alienated. It doesn't come through because that presence of God is not there. And that's, if you will, where I think Hollywood gives us the scam, sells us the line. They basically think, well, if you've got that calling and that determination and everything, you know, you will be able to do it on your own. Right, that kind of rugged individualism that we expect of the hero. And I think that's where the distinctive difference is. The God's promise, I will be with you, is what's missing. And that's why all of us are so disappointed when we go through our superhero phase. Come on, don't laugh. You've done it. You've all gone, right? Come on. When haven't you thought somewhere in your life that you're going to be able to save the world? Right? Now, you don't have to admit that to me, but, and the bell rang, so you don't even have to confess here, but, you know, as you're staring into that cup of coffee in that existential way, just think about it. Thank you. Have a good afternoon.